Our meeting format calls for a guest speaker followed by open discussion. Our guest speaker will share for 30 to 45 minutes. At our speaker's discretion, we may invite questions from the audience for up to 10 minutes before we begin the discussion portion of our meeting. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's chairperson, Jen Daly, who happens to be the CNIA delegate, which is the California Northern Interior Area delegate for our area, with 27 years of sobriety.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jen, and I am an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And that sure makes me sound like I am somebody, like, super spiffy. And, you know, and if you are new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you don't know what the hell that any of that meant, you know, that's just fine. And if you are looking at me and you're like, oh, my gosh, she's so fancy. I did not walk into Alcoholics Anonymous looking like this. So, you know, what I'd like to share with you all tonight is a little bit about, you know, what it was like, what happened, you know, what it's like now. And, you know, I always need to remember, you know, that, you know, that my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, is an absolute privilege. There are so many other places that I should be tonight. You know, and Jessica and I rolled up here in a car that is insured, has four matching tires, and I didn't steal it. You know, like, how about all that, you know? Like... That is super fancy, right? And so, I was not sure that I was going to live to see 30 before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, whether that was, you know, I died by my hand or by somebody else's, end up incarcerated or, you know, any number of things that can happen to us. And if you've stuck around Alcoholics Anonymous for any length of time, you know, you have seen a lot of the things that, you know, that we can do to ourselves. And so, you know, I need to remember that, you know, that I am just another, you know, as a friend of mine says, just another bozo on the bus. And it really is that simple. So I am... You know, I, to start at the very beginning, and I won't bore you with, like, a lot of my childhood, but, you know, some things that are important to know about me was that I was adopted at birth by very potentially the normalest couple on the planet. Like, so there is other dysfunction in the family that I was adopted into. I am the sole alcoholic in the bunch. You know, when my mom and dad tried for a long time to have a kid, and when that did not work out, they adopted me and my dad, especially after he started developing dementia and, like, you know, kept telling the same stories over and over. One of his favorites was, you know, like, about the day that he and my mother got me from the adoption agency and he elbowed my mother out of the way to get to me first. And I know that, you know, like, without a doubt, that, you know, when my dad got his hands on this little girl that he wanted more than anything, that, he, you know, his first wish wasn't, oh, I hope she, you know, grows up to be a lying, thieving alcoholic whore. Because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous 26 years later, that was what I had become. And, you know, and I am, you know, I, you know, like I said, I have been here in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. I'm doing my best because I know that there are small children here, and my, you know, I know your children will grow up in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the same way mine did. But, you know, I will try to be on my best behavior, but I can't guarantee that, you know, and length of sobriety doesn't mean that that has, you know, always changed. But, so I grew up in this really normal family, like, who didn't, you know, I don't, nothing bad happened for them. And nothing really bad happened for me, but like from the get-go, there was that hole. You know, something was wrong with me, or at least, you know, like something was wrong, and I figured it couldn't be me, it had to be you. It was always somebody else's fault. I didn't know, like, what to do with that. And because everybody else, you know, I have a brother and sister, my parents' biological children. They're a little bit younger than me. You know, nobody else was having this. And I didn't know how to talk to, you know, nobody in my family needed to talk about this. And so I didn't know what to do. And by the time I was 13 years old, that was so bad that I was actively trying to kill myself. On more than one occasion, I would, you know, get a hold of whatever pills I could find in the medicine cabinet. I would take a whole bunch of pills. I would get really sick. I would throw up. My mother, you know, would think that I had food poisoning, which was not a, you know, outside the realm of possibility given my mother's cooking. But, you know, I wasn't telling anybody what was going on. Like, I did not want to be fixed. I did not need, you know, to go to the mental hospital and have them, you know, try and fix me. I wanted to be dead. And I was perfectly okay with that decision. But obviously, you know, like, it wasn't working out. And so I, you know, when I was 13 years old, you know, I found alcohol. And alcohol, without a doubt, saved my life. It did for me what I could not do for myself. You know, all of those things that I didn't think that I was. You know, if it was funny or pretty or whatever, you know, it's like I wasn't, you know, I didn't think I was those things, and, you know, alcohol made me feel like I was. It didn't last very long. You know, I like to point out that I did not get this nose because I lived a virtuous life. I am a brawler. I love to fight. And, you know, I was in my first bar fight. When I was 17 years old, I don't know what the deal was, you know, like, there are a lot of other, you know, things that are part of my story, but drinking was always very easy for me to do. And, you know, and drinking in bars, you know, even pretty young, was pretty easy to do. You know, my senior year in high school, you know, my parents, you know, had this really, like, in my mind, totally unreasonable expectation that, you know, their 17-year-old daughter come home at a reasonable hour, which in their minds was 1 a.m. or 3 a.m. if I was working, because I worked in a restaurant, and that I'd be sober when I do that. You know, and so, you know, when I was, you know, wandering in at, you know, noon the next day, you know, still wasted, you know, they took exception to that. And I just couldn't understand what the problem was. Like, you know, I'm having a great time. You know, I made it home. You know, I'm in one piece. You know, I'm sure as hell not going to tell you what I was up to all night. And, you know, my mother and I would get into these fights, and one day, about halfway through my senior year of high school, and I was not drunk. I was not on anything at the time this went down. So this was, you know, with a completely clear mind. You know, my mother and I got into this, you know, this argument, and I escalated it into a physical altercation. You know, so I took a swing at my mom because she thought that, you know, her 17-year-old daughter needed to come home sober. You know, needless to say, that did not go over well. I ended up, you know, I was like, screw you people, I'm out of here. And so I moved out, and the story of my drinking is basically without adult supervision, you know, it goes sideways. And, you know, for, you know, the rest of high school, you know, it didn't get any better. You know, like, moving out did not fix my problems. You know, I was still doing, you know, all of the amazingly sketchy things that we can do, you know, as alcoholics. You know, and then I started in on the plan. Because, you know, I think as alcoholics, you know, you've all at one time or another, like this. This is the thing that's going to fix it, right? And so, you know, the first one of these super brilliant ideas was, let's get married. You know, I found this guy, and he was, I think like, I have so many stories of my drinking this service. There was this guy. Or there was this girl. You know, like it was, I always sucked somebody into this, right? So I got married. We had a baby. We got divorced just about that quick. I got married again. Did not have any more kids. You know, there were a bunch of jobs. You know, just a bunch, you know, of that insanity that goes along with drinking, you know, and like, I don't think I need to tell you all of the crazy because you've all lived it. You know, just that, you know, the things that I was doing, you know, as I was drinking was, you know, not the kind of stuff that I could tell my grandma about. Mm-hmm. You know? It's like, you know, my grandma was a good woman. You know, and, you know, she raised her family and she paid her bills. And God forbid, you know, it would have never occurred to her to drive drunk with her kids in the car. You know? And, I could barely pay my bills. You know, I drove drunk with my kid in the car all the time. You know, all of that stuff. That, you know, I think, you know, the longer we drink, you know, it like starts to sink in that hole that we were covering with alcohol. You know, like it just gets worse and worse and worse. You know, it's like an ulcer. And, you know, we can't ignore the fact that, you know, there are people that we know who are doing, you know, who would be appalled. You know, with the behavior. Like, we try and tell ourselves, oh, no, I'm having a great time, this is fun, you don't get it, whatever, but, you know, it's in there. We know. And, you know, there were a couple of marriages. There were a whole bunch of other relationships. All of those overlapped. They were all very messy. You know, the fact that I had been married to the same man, in sobriety for 25 years, nights and weekends is like really impressive to me, because that was not something I could do when I was drinking. So my poor second husband, who was a really good guy, you know, and like I said, I needed to always find a good codependent to take care of me because somebody had to pick up after me, you know, make sure that my bills were paid and, you know, the kid ate and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, I don't think we were very far into our marriage where, you know, he's like, Jen, you're a drunk and you need to quit drinking. You know, when I was 20, 22, 23 at this point, you know, wasn't very old. I was like, oh no, you know, I'm having fun. And he was considerably older than me. I was like, you already had your fun, you know, let me have mine. And every once in a while, just to get him off my back, I would quit drinking for a period of time. And a week was, like, totally sufficient, right? You know, see, I can quit drinking for 7 days. I am not an alcoholic. Thank you very much. But in that week without drinking, like, if I don't have alcohol to, like, fix the, you know, just all of that, crazy, and I hate to use the word crazy because it's not insanity. It's the, you know, the untreated alcoholism. If I don't have alcohol to take care of that, I am, you know, I am mean. I hiss, I spit, I scratch, I bite, you know, all of that. You know, my son likes, you know, he was barely old enough to remember this, but, you know, I completely lost it trying to make a pie crust, and I threw it across the room and missed him, like, by that much, you know? Like, it was that kind of insanity, you know? Without the alcohol, you know, there's no solution. So everybody is usually really grateful when I started drinking again. I'd lighten up a little bit. And then it would escalate, you know, John, you're drunk and you need to quit drinking. It's like, You know, and there was marriage counseling, and the counselor seemed to think that maybe I needed to think about not drinking, and, you know, I thought she was crazy, and so we didn't go back there. You know, all of this. And, but what happened in all of that was, by the time I got to, you know, around my 25th birthday, the hole was back, and the alcohol wasn't fixing it. And no matter how much I drank or what else I did, it wasn't fixing it. And, you know, I would wake up in the morning and I'd be like, I am still here. You know, it was just exhausting. And I didn't know what to do with that. You know, suicide was still, for me, a very viable option, but I just didn't know how to pull that off with this adorable, blonde-haired, blue-eyed little kid that I was raising, you know. And so I was like, okay, well, maybe, you know, maybe I'll just wreck my car, and that wasn't happening, you know, or maybe I'll get in the wrong car with somebody and something, you know, something awful will happen. And, you know, and the fact was, at 25 years old, you know, like, I did not get sober. I did not think about getting sober because I was, you know, was afraid of dying. What I realized when I was 25 years old was that I was afraid that I could potentially live for another 50 or 60 years with my life looking exactly like it did right then. And that was what, you know, was just unbearable to think about. So finally, my second husband is like, he was done, you know, and in this amazing moment of self-preservation, he said, I am done watching you kill yourself. You've got to go. And I seemed, you know, again, to think that this was very unfair. If he really loved me, you know, he would just do it right, you know, like that selfish, self-centered alcoholic. And, you know, so I moved out. And at the time, you know, this was, you know, the end of 1994, going into 1995, I moved out on New Year's Eve. And I remember, you know, I was sitting in my new house, on the floor, because my brother thought it would be really funny to leave the couches on their ends like columns, you know, so I didn't have anywhere to sit, you know, unless I got somebody else to knock the couches over for me. So I'm sitting on the floor drinking a bottle of Jack Daniels on New Year's Eve because I have absolutely nobody I can talk to about what's going on inside of me. You know, that hole that I had in my soul, I still didn't have any way of talking to another human being about, you know, the guilt and the shame and the anger and all of it. You know, like I said, my second husband was a good guy, but I didn't know how to tell him. He was like, what the hell is wrong with you? Why won't you just not do that? And I was like, oh. You know, I didn't have a good answer for him. I worked for a theater company at the time. I've had a bunch of really, really odd, interesting jobs over the years. And I was working for a theater company at the time, and on New Year's Day, 1995, we started our tech rehearsals for a production of Romeo and Juliet, and I was the technical director. And so basically, at this point, you know, I'm standing in the back of the theater, chain smoking, because that's pretty much all I did. You know, if I wasn't drinking, I was smoking or doing both of them at the same time. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, they are better off dead anyway. You know, they would have hated each other in 6 months. And that was, you know, that was my take on Romeo and Juliet, you know, at 25 years old, was that, you know, I was just so much of a curmudgeon and so much of a cynic. And again, you know, without adult supervision. You know, it just got worse. All, you know, we all set those lines, you know, in the sand. You know, well, if I was an alcoholic, you know, alcoholics do this, you know, or I would never do this, you know, and like I said, you know, without somebody, you know, kind of keeping tabs on me, you know, again, you know, driving drunk, you know, with my kid in the car, taking my kid to the bar, taking my kid to buy drugs, you know, like whatever, you know, I needed to do. I was going to do it. And then finally I came to a point where nothing terrible happened, but, you know, things started going sideways in little tiny bits, and I was like, well, maybe I need to not be drinking quite so much. And so my solution to that, you know, like to try and control and enjoy my drinking, right, was to hang out in these coffee houses that were open until 3 a.m. And I can tell you, you know, whether it is a bar or a coffee house, nothing good happens after midnight. I can get into all of the same trouble sober in a coffee house at 2 a.m. that I could drunk in a bar. And so I met this guy, right? He was in the process of getting divorced. He was couch surfing. And, oh, my God, I loved him. Like, 2 weeks, he's living with me. The problem was he had about 6 years sober. He had not been going to meetings, you know, and, you know, hence the disaster that his life was. You know, so now I am living with somebody who is sober, and oh my God, that is really awful to try and like pull off drinking enough that you can like ease the crazies, but not so much that you piss off your sober partner. You know, I that did not always go very well, but. You know, I really tried, you know, to play like, you know, I had it together. And then he realized one day that, like, you know, for him, you know, all of the stuff that was going on in his life, you know, that he needed to start going back to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this big book showed up in our living room. And I wish I could say, you know, like I sat down and I read it because it was something that it was important to him, or whatever. You know, I mean, those were the stories I was trying to tell myself, but I sat down, and, you know, one day, I had lost my, you know, I'd lost the full-time job that I had at that point. So I was home all day. I sat down one day and I read the first 164 pages of the big book. Now I had, you know, I had known people who were sober in AA before this. I had seen the steps, you know, on the wall in various places. And I really had absolutely no idea, you know, what all of that meant. But what I got when I read the first 164 pages of the big book, was that if I quit drinking and I did some things, that maybe my life could be different. And that was a new idea for me because I knew I could quit drinking for a period of time, but I didn't know what to do after that. And so, you know, that idea that there were some things that I could do that maybe would make my life better. I had no idea what that meant. I had no idea what I was going to do about the God thing, you know, all of it. But I had this really, really crazy idea that if I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I did what you people suggested, that maybe my life could be different. I did not wind up in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous for another 2 months, about. My boyfriend, you know, one day he came home and he said, I'm going to go to a meeting tonight. Do you want to go with me? And I said, sure. The night before, we had gone out to dinner, and I had had a glass and a half of wine, because remember, I'm trying to control and enjoy my drinking. And I had really planned on drinking more. And I had never, had I known that that was going to be the last thing I ever drank, I would have planned accordingly. So my last drink is a glass and a half of wine, which seems like so wimpy, right? But, you know, so I went to, went to my first meeting. And if you ever have the opportunity to take somebody to their first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous ever, I'd like to make a recommendation. Do not take them to a meeting in a creepy old house that's a candlelight meeting at 11 o'clock at night. My first meeting was at a place called the Lindo Club in the Central West End in St. Louis. It is this old, early 20th century, it was a mansion, it's kind of a dump now, kind of house. And the meeting was, you know, upstairs on the second floor, and you come in and the lights are all off, and you walk into the room, and it was a long, skinny room with those red candles with, like, the mesh around the outside. That's it in the room. And you could smoke in the Lindo Club at the time, except, like, I have no idea what the hell's going on, and I am shaking so bad. And I was afraid to try and, like, light a cigarette, you know, or, you know, it's going to light the whole place on fire. And I have no idea what anybody said in that meeting. But we were sitting, you know, in around this table, and they started going around the table, and when they got to me, I said, you know, my name is Jen, and I am an alcoholic, and I knew it was true. And that was July 18th, 1995, and I have not had a drink since then. And I am way more impressed with that than you all are. I had no idea, you know, when I said that for the first time at the Lindo Club, that's how, you know, things were going to work out. I did not do 90 meetings in 90 days. I went to my second AA meeting 8 days later. It was on a Sunday night. It was in a church fellowship hall like this, and the lights were on. So, like, that was just amazing to begin with. And without knowing the language of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wanted what those people had. And so I went back the next week and the week after that. And that was it for AA, you know, at the beginning. Finally, after, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 weeks of going to that one meeting a week, it was suggested that I go talk to these little old ladies that sat in the back of the room. And the room was set up in rows with this one table that was perpendicular to the back wall. And there were six little ladies that sat back there. And I have been sober as long as some of them, you know, or longer than some of them, you know, were at the time that I got sober now. And if you are not sober, or if you're not serious about getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, do not go talk to the little old ladies. I introduced myself to them, and Sis had gotten sober in 1952, and Kathy in 1969, and the rest of them in the 70s. They knew who I was, because they'd been paying attention, you know, to who the newcomers were in the room. And, you know, Kathy asked me if I had a sponsor, and I didn't know people lied about this stuff. I was afraid that if I didn't do what was suggested or, you know, tell you the truth, that you were going to, like, kick me out or something, and so I told her no. And she's like, oh, well, this is Shannon, and she will be your sponsor. And I swear to God, like, the whole hand flip was in there, too. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, like I said, I did not look like this. I was 26 years old. I weighed 95 pounds. Like I said, all I did was chain smoke. I still wear a lot of black, but what I was wearing at the time was like wildly inappropriate. My hair was a color called hibiscus, and I had a button on my coat that said, "Guess where I'm pierced." Wow. And Shannon was 23 years old, and she was, you know, very perky and happy, and she had pretty curly hair, and she wore flowery sundresses, and she's like, "Oh my God, I'm so happy to be your sponsor!" And she gave me this great big hug, you know, and like, I'm just trying to figure out how to get her to let go of me. And she took this step back from me, and she looked at me with this really, really serious expression on her face, and she said, "Call me every day." And, you know, I am so incredibly grateful that she said that, and that she said it in the way that she did, because I knew she was serious about Alcoholics Anonymous. And, like I said, you know, I wasn't always that bright when I was a newcomer, and then, you know, I figured if I didn't call her, you know, I wasn't going to be able to come back, so I started calling her every day. And we started working the steps. And, you know, I was going to meetings, started branching out to other meetings. You know, I was working the steps and calling Shannon. But I had it in my head that I didn't need to change everything. I am not drinking, right? That's an improvement for everybody. You know, I thought I could still kind of keep doing some of the same old behavior. The boyfriend did not last very long. You know, he realized that the last thing he needed in his life was a newcomer girlfriend. He had his own stuff to figure out. So he bailed. You know, and so, you know, like my first, you know, 6 months, was just, you know, stray boys and writing bad checks. Because back in the day, you could write a check, cash it, you know, and then like get the money in the bank a couple of days later. And, you know, so it was all of the same old behavior other than I was just not drinking. That really kind of came to a head for me when I ended up involved with this guy who was really possessive and abusive. And for somebody like me who likes to fight, that doesn't go well. You know, I am 6-7 months sober, and, you know, once again, living with this guy. And, you know, we are having knockdown, drag-out fights on a regular basis. I had done an inventory. I had shared that with my sponsor. And, you know, I had been trying, you know, as a newcomer to like figure out this whole acceptance thing. You know, what to do with this relationship I was in, because I knew it wasn't, you know, I knew it wasn't a good scene. I didn't know, you know, I think sometimes as newcomers we think that, you know, when we talk about acceptance, that means that we just have to kind of take everything that comes. And then I had a moment that is more profound than anything that led me to actually quit drinking. You know, it was the moment at which I became willing to change everything, to go to any length, and it. Yeah, I was in my car. I was driving home. I was just like, oh my, you know, that sick feeling when you're going into a bad situation. You know, like I just did not want to go home and deal with all of this. And I pulled up to the stop sign at the corner of Devonshire in January in South St. Louis, about 3 blocks from where I lived. And this blinding flash of the obvious. And the courage to change the things I can. And in those 3 blocks between, you know, where I stopped and where I got home, you know, I became willing to change the things that I could. And that started with kicking him out. And it ended up taking the courts and the police and a restraining order and a lot of really hard stuff. But, you know, I became willing to go to any lengths to stay sober, and that included, you know, maybe I needed to go live in my mom's basement, or I needed to, you know, whatever. You know, like, I did not need to, you know, keep telling myself the stories that I was telling myself, you know, where to make me think that I needed to be okay. And, you know, and that was the point at which, you know, all of this stuff started to change. You know, over the years, you know, I have had, you know, just a, I mean, I could go on for, you know, the rest of the evening, you know, about all of the gifts that I have been given as a direct result of getting and staying sober. But, you know, what I think I want to talk about, you know, for the remainder of my time, is a little bit about, service. You know, as it was mentioned, you know, I am of service to our area, which, you know, for most of you and for those of you who are new, you know, that is something that, you know, at some point in the future, you know, might be something, you know, of interest to you. But, you know, starting very, very early on, you know, I was taught how to get out of myself. And the third different AA meeting I ever went to was the group that became my home group and met on Tuesday nights. And there was this old timer there named Joe. And Joe had gotten sober in the early 70s and started this meeting. And, you know, when he was about 20 years, maybe about 15 years sober, I don't know, somewhere in there, you know, Joe had some time sober, and he got busy. He was a traveling salesman and, you know, was away from home a lot. And one day when he was on an airplane, the guy next to him ordered a drink and Joe said, "I'll have one too." You've all heard this, right? You know, some version of this story. Joe almost died, woke up in the hospital after a couple of years of drinking and, you know, and realized that, you know, he needed to go back to his home group. So he came back to that meeting that he had started and had to tell them that, you know, he had relapsed. And so when I showed up there, Joe had about, you know, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 years. And he was this little old guy and he looked really frail. And he was a sneaky bastard. He was like, "Can you show up early and help me make coffee next week?" And, of course, you had to show up, you know, because you didn't want him to hurt himself, right? And, you know, and you'd show up, you know, half an hour early, and he was there, and a whole bunch of his buddies were there, you know, these really amazing, you know, old-timer men. And not the, you know, I spilled more than you drank kind of old-timers, you know. You know, they loved Alcoholics Anonymous. And so they showed me how to show up for my home group. And one of the things Joe always said was, you know, President of the United States could call him up and say, you know, "I want you in Washington on Tuesday night." And, you know, Joe always said, you know, I'd say, "I'm sorry, sir, that's my home group." And I believed Joe, a couple of different fronts, one having been a salesman in the Midwest. I believe, you know, absolutely, you know, that there was a very good chance that he knew Bill Clinton, and two, that he would have told him no. You know, so I showed up for that group, you know, and I had the, you know, I had the opportunity, you know, in the years that I still lived in St. Louis, you know, to be of service to that group, you know, whether it was the secretary or the treasurer or the GSR or, you know, the coffee maker, you know, I got to be of service to that group. When I was about 5 years sober, I had the opportunity, I got a phone call from my friend Kathy, and Kathy had this way about her where she, instead of saying, "Would you do this?" she would say, "The trash is full." "Yes, ma'am, I'll take the trash out." You know, those kinds of things. You know, I'm sure you've all met you know, somebody in your life that, that worked you like that. And Kathy called me up one day, and her husband had was sick, and she was going to take a leave of absence from the central office where she worked. And she said, they need volunteers at the central office. I said, yes, ma'am. I will call as soon as I get off the phone. And that led me to working at the central office for several years after that. And what I learned, you know, in working at an intergroup office, you know, and this was not a newcomer job. This was, you know, with a little bit of time sober. So as a newcomer, I learned how to be of service to my group. And then, you know, at 5 years sober, I had the opportunity to learn how to be of service to the broader AA community. You know, I answered phones on the hotline. I worked with the eastern area of Missouri, the general service area there. I worked with the district treasurers. And so I got to see, you know, not the inward-facing service of, you know, doing sponsorship in service to your group, but, you know, sponsorship or service to AA as a whole. And that's where that journey started. And, you know, and I found that that was the service that fit for me. You know, I believe that we all find this service in Alcoholics Anonymous that fits us, you know, and our temperaments and our personalities best. I personally think I am terrible at sponsoring newcomers. I have had newcomers that would maybe disagree with that, but, you know, it is not what I think I do well if I had to, you know, do a self-critique. But, you know, I love committees and agendas and stuff like that. You know, I can sit through business meetings like a pro, you know, when it comes to AA. When I moved out here to California in 2006, I needed to get involved with something. You know, for any of you who have maybe moved or known somebody who's moved, you know, it's really easy to move and it's like they don't do it right. You know, this is wrong. You know, this is not, you know, what I know. And I had watched, not my first sponsor, but my second sponsor do that. She had moved. And didn't like the meetings, got busy, and she drank. And when I moved out to California, she'd been drinking for about 8 years at that point. And I would see her every once in a while, and she'd be like, oh, yeah, I just got 90 days sober. I just got out of this halfway house, or I'm in treatment, or this, that, or the other. And she knew all the right things to say. But I have been here long enough to believe that it is absolutely possible to drink past your bottom to the point where you know all the right things to say. But, you know, I saw it in her, and I've seen it in other people. They have ceased to believe that the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous can work for them. And, you know, so Debbie had been drinking for 8 years when I moved out here, and I did not want that to be true for me. I did not want to get too busy, or not like the meetings, and, you know, go back out because, you know, the options for me, you know, seemed pretty bleak. So I got involved in general service, which, you know, if you think about, you know, our 12-step work, and we talk about sponsorship where we are working with an alcoholic who's just walking into the rooms. General service is a lot about, you know, the alcoholic who isn't even here yet. You know, the decisions we make about new pamphlets or new books or things like that. And so I when I moved out here, Debbie was drinking, and I got involved as a general service rep for a group that really didn't want one. And, you know, and I played along because I needed something to do. You know, and, you know, a few years later, I ended up moving to Michigan for a year. And I knew I was 9 months, and, you know, and I knew I was going to be coming back, and it seemed like a whole bunch of trouble to move me and my husband and the cats and everything, you know, all the way across the country, you know, when I didn't know whether or not we were coming back. So, you know, my husband stayed here, and I moved by myself. And right before I moved to Michigan, I got a phone call from a friend of mine in St. Louis, and she said, Debbie died by suicide. And for somebody like me, you know, where that is a very real plan. You know, like I knew that, you know, no matter what, I needed to make this move to Michigan work. And so I did the same thing. I went there and I got involved. And, you know, and when I came back here, you know, I continued to try and be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. My role as delegate is to serve, you know, all of you. There are 93 areas in the United States and Canada. Ours is the California Northern Interior area, which is everything from this part of the state north to the Oregon border. And so I have the privilege of representing, you know, the groups at the General Service Conference in New York at that, you know, for 2 years. And the conference happens at the end of April, you know, and we talk about those decisions, like, do we need to update pamphlets? Do we need, you know, we're currently working on a fifth edition of the Big Book. We are working on what's called a plain language translation of the Big Book, which is, as an educator, that is this project that is so near and dear to my heart. That, you know, so there are all of these things, and you know, that you know, have to be guided by the fellowship. These are decisions that do not come from the conference; they come from you, and you all guide the conference in the decisions that you want made. And so, you know, I am really humbled, and my gratitude leaks out my eyes. I cry about the stupidest stuff. Like, I will cry at my home group about this, you know, when we read Tradition 7 in July. You know, it is humbling to get, you know, to carry that to New York. So, you know, if, I know that a lot of that, you know, if you are new, doesn't mean a damn thing, and that's okay. Just know that, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is something that we all own. It is ours. There's nobody in charge saying that you people have to do this. You know, it is kind of the very much the other way around. You all get to say, you know, we'd like to see this. And, you know, and those of us, you know, who get to participate in that, who are elected to serve in that, you know, it is, our privilege to do that. So I have been talking for a very long time. I am going to stop now. But, you know, I just want to say that, you know, I don't dread the next 50 or 60 years of my life. You know, I have lived, you know, I've lived well past 30. And I've been able to see grandchildren, you know, and that was not something that I thought was going to happen. So, as my friend Bob always used to say, you know, I have been given mercy over justice. And so I think that is all I have. Thank you very much. That's all I got.
Thank you. And our speaker has agreed to 10 minutes of questions. However, that's going to put us with only 10 minutes for discussion. So if everyone's cool with limited time for discussion, or does anybody feel the need to talk? Okay. What? Question?
Just a question. Do you guys have a suggestion to do a DVD?
For... So if you have a suggestion for something that you would like to see, there is a process for how that, you know, how you start to, you know, get that ball rolling. I am happy to help you, but Ellen and Dave are also part of this, you know, so, you know, these are guys local that, you know, can you know, help you start to, you know, formulate ideas. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you for your story.
When did you find out you were adopted?
At birth.
Oh,
I've always known.
Okay. And then social studies, you found out in the later age, you thought that was a result of your research and probably.
No, I've always known, and I've also always been grateful to know that that was, you know, it was an act of great love on the part of my biological parents.
Have you ever met your biological parents?
No.
Would anybody online like to ask a question?
Hi, my name is Matt, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Matt.
Hi, thank you for coming to be with us. Your story is very, very compelling, and I, for one, am very glad to hear of a plain language big book. How long has that been in the works? Did it meet with a lot of opposition? How was it? How big was the groundswell of support for it to come about? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I can tell you a little bit about that. My role at the conference, in addition to being the delegate for this area, is that I serve on the literature committee at the conference. There are 13 conference committees, and currently this year I'm serving as chair of that committee. The initial idea for a plain language big book came about at the based on a presentation that was given at the 2015 International in Atlanta. You know, and it came out of some prison groups in Canada where sponsorship, one-on-one sponsorship with incarcerated alcoholics in these, you know, really remote prisons in Canada, you know, is very low. And there are very low literacy levels. And, you know, so this presentation was about, you know, what can we do to reach those alcoholics? And from that, you know, over the last 10 years, there have been, you know, these pushes, you know, like, okay, maybe we need to do that. And we've had some discussion. It's like, maybe not yet. But in 2021, that came before the conference again, you know, it was brought by several different groups, and the conference decided that, yes, we want to go ahead with that project. There are currently 6 chapters of the book, the preface, the doctor's opinion, a foreword, that have been translated into plain language, which is a very specific writing style. And we are going to have the opportunity to see that at the conference. And what we're going to be looking for is not to, like, edit the book, but, you know, the language of the heart. And I talked about this today, is that we are, you know, we're going to read it and see if it is the same, you know, kind of feeling that, you know, we hear in meetings. And so they are hoping that, you know, we have this discussion at the end of April, and that will guide the rest of the project, which they are hoping to have finished by this summer. The book could be approved for publication as early as next April. The 5th edition of the big book, the 4th edition of the Spanish big book are also projects that are in the work. And so the plan is to have all of those ready, fingers crossed, by the 2025 International in Vancouver. So we should have all 3 of those books in the next few years.
Logan, I'm an alcoholic. How soon through going through the work with your sponsor did you start sponsoring other women, and what were some challenges?
I don't know. I was maybe... I did not get all the way through all 12 steps before I sponsored my first woman. I don't know that I did it very well. But you know, what it was told, you know, was told to me was like, you need to be at least a step ahead. you know, I don't think there's any like right, you know, in my opinion, there's no right or wrong time to like start working with somebody. You know, even if it's just, you know, sharing with them your personal experience. So the main thing I think for me was, you know, it made me start to get out of myself. And there's this adage in med school, and I am not a doctor, but there's this adage in med school, see one, do one, teach one. And I think that is true, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like, you know, I come to meetings and I get to see it. You know, I get to the experience of doing it with my sponsor, and then I have to tell somebody else how to do it. Oh, I'm sorry.
When you're in the sobriety, what were your strengths in like your early sobriety and your strengths now? Did they change or did they stay the same in the current time? And like, is this how you have to live with right now? Is it the same in the beginning or is it more of God or your fellowship?
So the question, and I apologize to everybody who's on Zoom. I can't see you guys. So I'll repeat the question. Is like, what were my strengths in early sobriety, you know, and maybe what they are, you know, now, you know, has. And so when I was new, I think the thing that was really important for me was to start to move away from being so isolated. You know, I talked about, you know, being married to this really nice guy who I couldn't tell, you know, what was going on. And so AA, you know, kind of forced me, you know, into starting to develop relationships with other people, especially other women, you know, where we talked about things that mattered. The other lesson that I learned very early on was that you go to meetings. Go to meetings, no matter what. The way that I was taught was, you know, if you are going to meetings and you're not doing some of the other stuff, you will at least hear that you need to do the other stuff. If you're not going to meetings, you know, nobody's going to tell you that. You know, and so there have been points in my sobriety where I have not had a sponsor. There have been points in my sobriety where I did not want to read the literature. You know, willful child, you know. But because I have always gone to meetings, you know, it has always brought me back to those things, you know, the things that worked when I was new.
Go ahead, Angel.
Angel Alcoholic.
Hey, Angel.
In your recovery, was there something that you heard from somebody, like a quote or anything like that, that you kind of used in your recovery and still kind of live by today?
Whew. A quote from somebody in my recovery. I don't know that there is a quote from somebody that I know that, you know, it maybe like defines my sobriety or something like that. But I do know that there are these people. And, you know, so, you know, what I try to remember, you know, like in my sobriety and the people in it, I tell the Joe story all the time and I tell the Kathy story all the time, you know, because like I need to remember their impact on my sobriety and I need to remember, you know, where it is that I came from, you know, and that, you know, phrase, you know, I've been given mercy over justice was, you know, something I got from my friend Bob. And, you know, there's just all of these people who have touched my recovery, you know, and, you know, all three of those people happen, you know, are dead now, because that's also the other thing that happens when you stay sober for a long time is people, you know, die sober, which is really cool, too, you know. But, you know, some of those people I have known, you know, for decades. you know, because some of those people who knew me when I was that crazy ass newcomer, you know, are still alive, you know, and I still do see them.
Grand alcoholic. When you went through your 12 steps, did it take you more than once to actually grasp it?
Yes. My first fourth step was not, it was as fearless and thorough as I could be at the time. Like I said, you know, I was still doing a lot of crazy stuff. Like, it was not objectionable. When I was, you know, bringing home stray boys was not objectionable at 6 months sober. you know, at a year sober, it was a very different thing. And at 5 years and 10 years and, you know, so, like, it just, things, you know, just look different, you know, at different points in your sobriety.
Ms. Callie, alcoholic.
We're
out of time for questions, but so we're now going to start the discussion part of the meeting. We've got about 13 minutes for that. We'd like to hear from as many people as possible, so please limit your sharing to allow for this. Our format calls for the speaker to call on people to share. This allows our in-person and remote attendees to have a chance to participate. So I will now turn the meeting back over to Jen to pick from people to share. So these are in-person attendees, and these are
online. Yeah. All right. So I don't know any of you, so there's, like, no, like, personalities that get sucked into this. So I am, let's see, there are two angels on here. Never mind. I'm delusional. So let's see. Let's do James. There are two angels on here. I am not delusional. Angel and Angel J? Angel, are you the same person? You signed twice.
You said James, right?
James, yeah.
James.
James.
Oh,
okay. How about Vito?
Vito, I'm calling.
Hey, Vito.
So was there a topic? Am I just sharing?
Talk about whatever you want.
Thank you for sharing, first off. I appreciate you being here. As you were sharing, I was here working on my second step, where I went out. But for me today, I'm doing the thing I did for myself. You know, I'm learning a lot about myself with all the books that I'm doing. It's crazy because you did mention something that, you know, I was just doing it out of my big book, working into my big book as far as what God did for me, what I can do for myself. And right when you shared that, I was doing it in my book, and I showed my book right here. But anyhow, so it goes hand in hand, you know, when you put it in the work, it shows, you know, everything that I'm doing, so much good things are happening because I'm doing the work, I'm doing the footwork, I'm going the extra mile. A lot of good things are happening and a lot of bad things as well. But for me, none of it matters if I don't have God in my life. You know, fearless and thorough from the very start. You know, and it's necessary for me. I'll speak for myself. I'm pretty grateful today. I got 223 days today. I'm able to share my story and just really listen and actually listen to others. I've been doing it a lot, but I never turned down to share. I'm truly grateful for everyone here. Whether you know me or not, you will get to know me because I'll be around for a long time. Okay. This is my way of life today. Not only here, but everywhere that I am, you know, I can't wait until I'm starting to work with others. I'm going to start sponsoring people. You know, that's my thing, to get out and help others. And it takes me to work just like I'm being taken to the work. You know, I'm going to do my fifth step. I'm going to fifth step apply tomorrow the next day. You know, I'm pushing forward. and I want to work with others. That's what it's about. I want to be the vision of God, you know what I'm saying? I want to do His work for Him. You know what I mean? I want to get outside of myself and do for others, you know what I mean? And do God's work, man. That's what it's about. I live with each and every one of you here, and I hope, you know, to be part of recovery. You know, stick around, because I'll be here. You know, if you guys want some help, hit me up. I'm more than welcome to lead you in the right direction. That's all I got. Thank you. Thank you.
How about Ivy?
Hi, Ivy.
Oh, hey, hi, Ivy.
So, thank you, Sharon. So, I've been going through it a little bit lately. Got a new job, and that thing made a toll on me. I wasn't even going to come tonight in and out, but I have to go. So, I'm here, and I'm really happy. So, thank you.
Thank you,
Ivy.
Thanks, Ivy. Let's see. Is that Jason H. on Zoom?
He's no longer logged in.
No. How about Nick R. on Zoom?
Nick, you would have to unmute yourself. I'm not getting a response.
Oh, okay. I'm trying to call on somebody. So, how about V on Zoom?
V?
Yeah.
She is logged in, but V. No. I'm not getting a response.
Okay, we'll try Rachel on Zoom. I'm trying, but I'm determined to get a Zoom person. And I can't see the screen, so...
Until she turns on her video, I wouldn't be able to put it on screen.
Well...
Oh, Rachel says, just listening.
Okay. Okay, so we'll do somebody in the room. How about Jonathan W.?
I'm Jonathan. I'm an
alcoholic. Hey, Jonathan.
I'm sitting up at our microphone. Okay. All right. So I noticed you were talking a lot about service, and I thought I'd talk about that a bit, too, because... I really love being of service to people. Being of service in AA is something that's new to me, but I'm still really excited for it. And so I found my first service thing. I don't even know what it's called, but I'm a greeter at my home group. And that's something that I'm actually pretty decent at. I'm pretty good at being enthusiastic and making people feel welcome and stuff like that. And, saying hi to new folks working on the pamphlet. So I'm really excited for doing that. Outside of AA, being of service is like one of my favorite things. Specifically, I love teaching people stuff. So that's why I'm a tutor and I want to be a teacher at some point. I would love to be a sponsor someday for that reason too. Because the idea of teaching someone and guiding them through is such a big part of their life. Teaching someone about the stuff you like kind of thing sounds like it would be really awesome, really helpful for someone. So I'm excited for that too. I'll just have to wait a little bit longer for that because I'm very new to recovery. I don't even have 90 days yet, but I'm still excited for all the things that are to come. So yeah. Service. Pretty cool. Yeah. Thank you.
How about Lindsay K?
Lindsay Omanetic.
Hey, Lindsay.
Thank you for your share. That was really great. I think it's great what you're doing. Like, too, I think that's really amazing. And I can imagine how amazing it is to do it for you, you know? But things are going really good, and just as Tia just said, I think it's, I've been doing a lot of service jobs myself, and I'm really loving it. I'm really enjoying it. But things are going really great, and I really appreciate where I am today. I mean, I'm just shy of 60 days, but I'm really grateful that I was told to go into treatment because I'm learning more about myself than I ever did in my last clean time of sobriety. And I kind of had a good little chunk under my belt. But even in these 60 days, I'm doing more, I'm seeing more, I'm even more happier, you know. And that's just in 60 days. And that whole 5 years, I wasn't. So I'm excited to see what's in store. And I can't wait to be a sponsor, too. I'm excited to do that stuff, you know. I'm really happy and I'm really grateful. And I'm grateful that she's with me all the time. It's a handful, but my friends are her friends too now. Yeah. They probably love her more than they love me. And so everything's just going really great, and I'm grateful for everyone I've met here. I'm also at home when I come and I go and volunteer, and when I come to my meetings, I love everybody, and I'm really grateful that I was supposed to go in there because I wasn't expecting. I was a loner by soul. That was just who I was, you know. I'm really grateful that I was asked to go because I really have gained a family that really gets me, you know, like a big one. So I love you guys, and yeah. Without getting another
phone. And I have known my friend Alan L. for a while now, years, and this is the first time we've actually had the opportunity to be in a recovery meeting together, so I'd love to hear from Alan.
Well, my name's Alan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Alan.
Thank you for your share. When you talked about sponsors and getting you into service and those kind of things, it just took me back a lot to my sponsor, Jack, who... that's what he did. He pushed me. I always thought I had a whole bunch of problems to take care of, and all he did was push me into doing things. And he introduced me to H&I, and he introduced me to we had the shift of after hours answering the phone at the AA central office out in San Diego when I lived down there, and I had a buddy that showed up the same night as me, and we became really good friends, and we had some really good times doing that. We had a guy one night call, and he was broke down, and he wanted to get some help with his car, and I, you know, I know we help each other in AA and stuff, but I said, you know, we're answering phones for people who need to get sober and stuff, and we're not really here to do that kind of stuff. And he says, well, isn't this the auto club? So anyway, he thought he was calling AAA. We laughed a lot after that. I forget who it was back here asking about was there a quote that stayed with you. And I had one where this guy, Scotty, I thought he said it in the meeting, but he said he was talking about, you know, doing our inventory and finding out why we do the things we do and all that. And he said... it's just people doing the things that people do, acting out of fear, or acting out of desperation for fear of being alone. And I hung on to that, and I thought these were words of wisdom, and I carried it around forever and ever. And a couple of years went by, and I said, you know, you said something once in the meeting, and it really stuck with me. And I rattled it off to him, you know, it was like a poem to me. I just rattled it off, and he goes, I never said that. And then someone mentioned the thing about, you know, doing the steps right and all that kind of thing. And I think about how superficial and shallow my first fourth step was, you know. But it was my best attempt, you know. I did the best I could with it. But there's so many things that just continue to add to my understanding of who I am and how I relate to the world around me as time goes by. And all the years I've been here, I remember when people used to talk about being selfish, self-centered, egomaniac with an inferior complex, and all that stuff. And I always kind of bought into it, and I kind of thought I saw it in myself. But it's only been in the past, 10 or 15 years where I've really come to understand what a big part of my personality is that that thing in the 12 and 12, the end of the 12 and 12, where they're talking about the psychologists who did the study on alcoholics and trying to find traits that they had in common. They narrowed it down to three biggies, and it was childishness, emotional sensitivity, and grandiosity. And I've come to see that that continues to be the thing that prevents me from just getting along well with the people around me and all that stuff. But it took me a long, long time to really see that that was a core part of my personality, even though AA and the books of AA and other people speaking and things like that have been telling me this for years. It's just my understanding had to keep breaking down this ego enough to start seeing stuff like that. So I wouldn't feel like, you know, we get this feeling, like at least I do, that I'm a piece of shit and I'm not worth being a part of unless I'm superior and beyond and all this kind of stuff, which I'll never be. But what AA has helped me to understand that this is, we claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. It means we continue to progress, you know, and we're all at whatever starting point we start at. And I am so grateful that, and like Jen said, you know, just showing up at meetings. You know, sometimes you're doing it well, sometimes you're not doing it so well. But if you keep coming to meetings, people keep reminding you of what you need to be doing and where you're off track and that kind of thing. So AA has certainly changed my life, but it's really been a much more gradual process than I came in thinking it was going to be. I thought it was going to, you know, shoot up to the top and be a big success and everything was going to be blah, blah, blah. But everything's different. And what the things I see as big achievements or big events in my life that have come to pass are much more humble things now than what I was kind of looking for at the beginning. So the beauty is that you get to come in here and work at it, and it gets to change. And as long as you don't pick up a drink, you always have a chance to continue to grow. And that's been the case for me, and I believe it's, you know, I still got plenty of growing to do, so and I'm looking forward to it. You know, some days I'll do it, I'll work at it, some days I won't. But I continue to ask God to show me what's next, and He continues to take care of me, so I'm pretty happy.
And Calvin, our colleague, let's thank Jen one more time for coming out.